Welcome to the Simple Development Systems Podcast, where you'll be learning all about small shop fundraising and how to build a donor-focused development department from the ground up. Here's your host, publisher of the Grow Report, Pamela Grow.
Hi, everybody. I'm Pamela Grow from Simple Development Systems, and today I am absolutely delighted to introduce you to one of my favorite people in the fundraising industry. This is John Lepp. John is the founder of Agents of Good. It's a Canadian agency that engages in really refreshingly donor-focused communications. Agents of Good has exhibits on SOFI, and I've also shared a number of their pieces on my site as well. Today, the focus of our conversation is going to be annual reports in part, but it's also something that the agents have coined, a gratitude report. So welcome, John, and thanks for being here today.
Thanks, Pam. I really appreciate it. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So I thought we would talk start out by talking a little bit about donor centricity and really what it means. If you could tell me what it means to you.
What it means to me, in a nutshell, I think what being donor-centered really means is recreating what it means to be a donor to an organization. And I think our job as fundraisers is to constantly sort of reimagine how we can add more joy to our donors' lives, regardless if they give $20 a year or $20,000 a year to our organization. And I think it's largely misunderstood that people think that it's just if you drop a few more U's into your crappy letter that it's then now you all of a sudden you're donor centered, and that's just not that's not a bad start, but that's not really what we're talking about here.
What are some ways that you think that there are certain ways that people can really understand it better?
Again, working with lots of different organizations of different sizes, what we really want, what we try to drive into their heads is that every time they start a new initiative, a new project, a new campaign, immediately they have to put themselves in the shoes of the donor. And again, I'm sure people are sitting there going, oh, I do that all the time. And part of that is understanding what is going on in and around your donor and their lives. And we'll touch on this, I'm sure, when we talk about the annual report. But part of it is that most donors, and certainly I know in Canada, and I think it's pretty much the same in the States, you know, they're 60 to 80 years old, they're female, they're usually white, they're usually educated. And these people who are really the real core of like direct mail donors, they get a lot of mail. So they get your mail and they get everyone else's crappy mail piece. And I know from the ones that I see through some of the Jane donors I know in Canada, largely the mailings are very boring. Creatively, they are lacking any kind of inspiration. They don't generally tell any kind of story. It's a lot of, here's the amazing work we're doing. Here's the things we're going to be working on. We did this. Look at this great picture of us shaking hands with someone, handing over a check. And it's these kinds of things. And it doesn't tell the donor how their last gift was used. It doesn't ask for anything really specifically, or it asks for a whole lot of things. It uses very tiny type. It uses a very small coupon. It's all very vanilla and boring. And to some charities, that's what they think it means to be donor-centered, or that they think they're doing their job properly. But I think the worst part, the most frustrating thing is that, again, in Canada, and I'm sure it is the same in the States, is that donors are a really generous bunch. And regardless of how crappy they are treated and ignored, these people still feel like they want to give because they still feel like they're not told, but they still feel like their $25 actually is making a difference. And I'm sure they don't even read it anymore. I think they may see an organization that they know something about and give out of the goodness of their hearts. And I'm not willing to play any part in taking advantage of their good nature and their grit, you know, their graciousness or their generosity in any way, shape, or form. I'm not sure I answered that question, but
wow.
It really means, I think, that you need to charities need to rethink when they're sending things out in the mail, whether they're putting something online, what the needs of their donors are, and what do they need to hear? How should they be feeling? What story will move them? How can they feel more appreciated, or how can they show more appreciation for that person who's reading it and considering the give than they ever have before? And if you're always putting your donor at the very beginning of your thinking on a project, then you're well on your way, I think.
I love that. When you talk about your donor and you talk about, say you've got, I'm just going to throw out a hypothetical. Say you've got 2,500 donors in your database who have at some point given. How do you go about segmenting them to look at them more as, maybe I hope I'm making sense with this, but more as individual human beings, as donors, rather than, oh, this person gave, you know, $50 a year for the last 5 years, rather than looking at them in terms of numbers, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, certainly. I've lost my patience on a number of fundraisers who, you know, continuously talk about data, where they're really talking about donors. And because I find it quite insulting that people are just thinking in terms of numbers. And you can get into segmentation and some of these tricks a bazillion different ways. And every consultant will tell you a different way to do it. But really think, you know, you can take a step back, and there's a couple little things to consider. One is when you are talking about a new project, whether you're with other fundraising consultants or not, you know, we often say put an extra chair in your boardroom or wherever it is you're having a meeting, and that chair belongs to your donor. And you need to pretend that they're sitting right there in that chair. And I don't care if they give $20, if that's who's in that chair, or if they're $20,000 and maybe they're the person in that chair. But you need to put the chair there, you need to picture them. They need to be in that room, and they need to hear you talking about them and your organization and your cause. And that's the best place to possibly start, you know. But the segmentation, you know, to answer your question, I don't want to see charities spending a lot of time. Yes, there are people who give to you a lot. They may give to you every time you send out an appeal, or maybe someone hasn't given to you in the last 5 years. But I think part of our role as fundraisers and as communicators is really to do things to help disrupt that status quo. You know, I've said to a fundraiser just last week, you know, that I think our donors get so used to seeing what we send them all the time, because usually it's the same thing over and over and over again. And really, I know part of my job is to go, how can I disrupt that expectation of what I think that donor thinks they're going to get when they get a piece from this charity. So what things can I do to disrupt it? Can I use a different envelope? Can I use a totally different voice? Can I totally change the creative? Can I hack the logo? Can I do anything that at least snaps them out of that sort of zone a donor gets into of what I'm expecting this will be and what it will say and how it will sound? So if you can start to disrupt that in some way, even from the very beginning, whether it's in an email or a DM piece, half the battle is already won. And I think that's our job too, is we're supposed to make this interesting for donors. God, you can't bore them to death and think they're going to keep it. Make it interesting, because they're interesting people and you're an interesting organization, hopefully, and you're doing interesting things with their donations. So at least give them that bone. At least make it interesting. If you're going to waste half an hour of their time, make it interesting, please.
As you put it, I think in a couple of your blog posts, surprise and delight.
Surprise and delight, yeah.
And I've seen that in a lot of your work. It's amazing. Well, we should probably move on to the topic of annual reports, because I know that you've done a lot of annual reports, and I'd kind of like to talk about the difference between a traditional annual report and something you call a gratitude report.
Yeah, the traditional annual report is the one, go up to a colleague in the industry and ask them about them working on their next annual report and watch their face.
Their eyes roll.
And the eyes will roll. There will be many sighs. Some will ask for a drink, you know. People hate working on annual reports because they're cumbersome, they're boring, just no one wants to do it. And again, if that's how you feel going into working on your report, I mean, can you imagine, you know, what the piece is going to end up looking like or sounding like, and really what your donors may or may not think about it. And I think I said this to you the other week, I've been looking for this email. I think it was about 5 years ago, somewhere on the internet. I saw someone refer to their annual report as a gratitude report. And I remember going,
as a what?
A gratitude report.
Oh.
And I thought, you know what? Yes. I mean, absolutely. It's like, you know, one of those light bulb moments where it kind of confirms the thing you think in your head and your heart, but you've never been able to express before. And so I sent it to Jen, who's my partner. And I said, yeah, this gratitude report, why aren't we focusing on making sure these reports are, really all about the donor? Why have we not thought about this in this way before? So we set out the next report that we were supposed to work on was for a charity in Toronto called Interval House, which is like a women's shelter. And we set out from the very get-go, the goal was to create a gratitude report that ideally the donor would find interesting, that really told amazing stories about how their money was used, that was creatively was striking. And like Jen often says, you know, that hopefully what's happened is that the donor, by the time they turn the last page, even to look over the pie charts, which also were represented very graphically and very interesting and uniquely, they nodded to themselves that when they gave that $50, you know, last June, that was absolutely the best decision they made all year. And that's what a gratitude report really should do. You know, it should be something that your donors should look forward to because they feel...
Wow. Wow, this reinforces that I made the right decision.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's, you know, you have to make sure that's what it's doing. But I've seen charities who want to call their reports gratitude reports, and they are not gratitude reports. And I also noticed in the last two to three years, an explosion of gratitude reports. If you just Google gratitude reports, you'll see them all over the place. And you can decide for yourself if you think they're gratitude reports or not, or if they're just annual reports called gratitude reports. But I do like the fact there are people thinking about rethinking what an annual report should be to their donors.
Wow. I will definitely check that out. I wasn't aware of that. I think, did I ever tell you my own personal story about?
No.
We talked a minute before we started recording, and I mentioned John to our listeners. John is a former graphic designer. Do you still do a lot of the graphic design work?
I do on occasion, yes. I still do my bit, yeah.
And I was as well, very briefly. And I worked for this organization early on in my fundraising career that was an organization I was very familiar with from when I worked at the Grant Making Foundation. We had funded them regularly. We just loved them. And they were working with women and children. It was both a shelter, and they also had different programs all through the city. It was a pretty large organization. I guess it'd be mid-sized, maybe about a $6 million a year budget. Anyways, I think I had been working there for maybe not too long, maybe 6 weeks when the development director, because I was actually the grant writer, came to me and said, we need an annual report. And we needed it like yesterday. She knew I was a graphic designer, and I had already done their appeal for them, I think. And then she said, but here's the thing. We don't have anything really to report because they'd gone through some big transition where the normal, all the stats on all the different numbers served and all the different programs, they didn't have that this year. They had just the bare bones because of this computer transition throughout the year. So they really didn't have anything to go on. And so I remember... I don't even know how I came up with the idea, but I thought, well, since we don't have anything to really report, we will just thank everybody who made this possible. And I started getting quotes from donors, quotes from foundations that had supported us. And that's how I did my first little tiny gratitude report that doesn't even come close to yours, but that's my story.
Okay.
sense.
No, I mean, that's great, though. I mean, would you want to read that? I'd want to read that, I think, as a donor. I mean, because it really confirms our, you know, our belief in, you know, that we made a gift that was important.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And well, yeah.
That's really what it should do. And you can tell it from many different perspectives. So I think, you know, I've seen people have done annual reports or gratitude reports, even just in a postcard. And that's it, because that was really all it needed to be. It didn't need to be 48 pages, because no one's going to read that anyways, you know?
No, exactly. No one's going to read it. This was, I think, a total of 4 pages.
Excellent.
And the feedback was amazing. I was really pleased, because I guess the reason I'm telling that story is that I actually had no idea what I was doing at the time.
Which sometimes is the best way to operate. But again, we were just talking about, which is disrupting that status quo, right? Of that norm of the expectation of what I think I'm going to get when I get an annual report from these guys. And you totally change that and turn it upside down. And it's that kind of thinking. Yours was coming from a different place of, oh my God,
what am I going to do?
What am I going to do? But still, that's sometimes the best position to be in to get you thinking a little more creatively.
It is. It is.
Yeah.
So if tell our listeners, like, if they wanted to put together their very first gratitude report, what do you think they should do? Where should they start?
With your donor, what do they need to hear and see from you to know that they made a really good decision when they gave you their gift throughout the year? And part of that is going to be the things that happened because of the donations you got. So there will be stories out of there, and maybe one of those stories will be the starting point or the spark of a creative way to tell that story.
Mm-hmm.
But start always with the donor. What do they, you need to know what they need to hear from you. And if you don't know, ask them. Call up some donors that randomly, or ones that you know, and ask them how they feel. Where did they feel?
Yes.
And what happened with the gift that they gave, and listen to them. Let them tell you.
And how hard is that? I think a lot of people have a really hard time connecting with their donors, or they think of, and what you just described is actually just a method of surveying.
Yeah.
And we don't have to think of surveying in terms of something that's very, very formal.
I think the biggest thing that I find, whether I'm sitting on a board or working with organizations or other fundraisers, that I think that we're all at the end of the day, and Pam, you and I have talked about this a little bit, you know, we're all a little bit afraid. I mean, the biggest thing we're afraid of is rejection. And I think that we're afraid to pick up the phone and call donors who I think really do like hearing from us, if we're not bugging them for money all the time. But if we're actually calling because we want to ask their opinion on something, they're usually happy to give it. But I think the other part of it too is that people, I don't know what it is. I think that we've unfortunately created a sector that it's become a little bit cold. And lacks emotion, which is strange when you're talking about fundraising and emotions and storytelling. But I know so many fundraisers who just don't, they like to keep a bit of a wall between themselves and their donors, because then they have to open themselves up as individuals, for better or for worse.
Right.
It seems like a very small thing, but I know many, many, many fundraisers who are absolutely petrified to add any level of personalization, because it adds a level of themselves to whatever it is they're doing, whether they're phoning a donor or they're writing an e-blast. And that's got to change. You know, that's got to change.
Yeah, that humanization in communications is so key.
Mm.
And it's still so lacking. Didn't I send you a letter once from one of our charities here in Philadelphia that...
I know you sent me a couple through the 3 years.
So when you're working with a client,
mm-hmm.
do you reach out to donors on your own, or is this something that you usually have them do?
A bit of both. It really depends on what we're doing with the report. Sometimes we do want to chat one-on-one with donors because we're interviewing them as part of the report. But we want to guide in terms of keep them focused on what kind of messaging we're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean we're telling them what to say, which just means this is the sort of the direction we're heading in with this piece. And we want to talk about, you know, how you celebrate yourself as a donor, and the ways that you do that in your life. And, you know, that's part of the theme of the piece. And then sometimes the organizations who should know the donors better than we ever should, obviously it makes more sense for them to do that work and to provide us with the right people to be involved or to chat further with. So it really depends on what the goal of the report is. But part of it is, you know, we automatically now think about the in terms of what stories we want to tell the donor, because they're important stories that they need to hear to feel that, like, yeah, I did a good thing here. And that once we figure that out and kind of come up conceptually with what the overall theme is, that guides in terms of who do we talk to, or what's the best way to pull this together, or what kind of photo shoots do we have to do, or is it all going to be illustrated? All those things sort of fall into place once we've thought through the theme and how we want the donor to feel at the end of it.
Do you have any words for our listeners on how to develop your theme?
Oh, God.
Some people really struggle with it. And I remember reading a quote. Well, I think everybody really struggles with it. But I read a quote from Tom Ahern. I wish I could find it. I wish I had it at the tip of. But he basically says, don't sweat it. Just find a theme and stick with it.
Yeah, I mean, because it's sort of like back to that segmentation thing. There's a bit of a bazillion different ways to approach it. And what I don't want, or people like Tom don't want, is for us to become frozen or so focused on how to slice it and dice it. We want you to don't overthink it. Your donors aren't going to. Don't get too clever. Like, the donors aren't going to care. They're going to care about hearing good stories and feeling appreciated. And wherever that takes you thematically, that's where it takes you. It's like, you know, logos. People get so wrapped up in their logo for their organization. Donors don't give a crap.
They don't at all.
And somebody carries so focused on their brand and how important that is that they become completely, again, it's like one of those forest for the tree situation. They've lost their way completely. So thematically, I mean, we're creative people, and our job is to bring some light and happiness into the lives of our donors. And if I can do that creatively, and I want to, then that's my job. But sometimes, you know, within 3 minutes of the first call about talking about the gratitude report, I know exactly what it's going to look like when it's done. And sometimes it's a journey, man. Like, it takes a long time, and it's really lots of, like, talking about it, walking away, mulling, coming back and talking about it, looking for some stories, looking at some pictures, listening to the organization and things they were doing this year, figuring out what the things we want to report back on. It's sometimes takes a long time, but that's our job as creative people. But I think if you're doing it yourself internally, don't get yourself wrapped up in coming up with a theme or a concept or something too clever. Don't be clever. Just make sure you say thank you a lot, and you tell a really good story or two, and make your donor feel really, really good about giving to you. That's it. That's your theme. Gratitude. That's your theme.
Yay. That the stories, John.
The stories.
The stories. I'm sure you have. You've worked with organizations that had 10, 20, 30 different programs. How do you decide how many stories you'll share, which stories you'll share, which programs you highlight?
Another really good question. I mean, it's sort of like the content sort of suggests that to you. I mean, if I'm given 3 stories, all of which just absolutely move me to tears, I'm going to tell them all. Mm-hmm. And you know what? Your donor's going to read them all. Like, you know, Pam, as well as I do, in the direct mail world, people argue about length of letters all the time. Should it be 2 pages? Should it be 4 pages? Should it be 8 pages? If you need 12 pages to tell the most incredible story you've ever told in your entire life, take 12 pages. If you only need half a page, only take half a page. So part of it is really what's in front of you. If you have 3 stories that are absolute dynamite, and again, you decide to call up a donor or two and tell them the story and ask them for their thoughts, and they're weeping on the other end of the line, you're going to use all 3 stories. Don't just use one. And don't try to create 6. Use what you have. But a lot of it, again, is that sort of inner intelligence to go, is this a really good story? does it really define and highlight, you know, the ongoing need, but also what was accomplished because our donors mm-hmm. actually cared, and use that as a bit of a guide in terms of what's a good story and not a good story. But again, hopefully you're human. I think we all are still. read the story. You know, like Jen, my business partner Jen, will sometimes write a letter for an appeal. And there's sometimes, man, I need to hang up on Skype because I'm ready to start bawling. And I know that we're in a good place. I read it as a donor and I want to feel something. And if I don't feel anything, I say, well, we've got further to go here. But read as a human, read as a donor. If you just go, oh, well, or ho-hum, then it's ho-hum. Don't bother using it.
You just brought to mind a quote that I have right up above my desk.
Give it to us.
It's actually from Indra Sinha. Don't start by writing, start by feeling. Feel and feel passionately, and the emotion you feel will come through the spaces in between the words. And that's what I'm always listening for when I'm doing my interviews, is that one key turn of a phrase, something that brings a tear to my eye.
Did we just do that?
Yes.
Excellent. It's so important. It's so important. But that, you know, that's to the point of people really being afraid to use their voice. You know, sometimes it takes a lot of work to tell a letter signer when we're helping them craft the appeal letter. That's important that we bring it back to a human emotional level. Well, I don't speak like that. Well, what's wrong with you? You don't talk like that? You don't feel like that? What? How do you talk to your partner in life? How do you deal with your kids? You're not that stone cold, you know? But again, there's that fear. Well, that's not how we sound as an organization. I'm not trying to make you sound like an organization.
Exactly.
Sound like a freaking human.
And, exactly.
You know, and I think that quote, to your point, is brilliant that way. It is the moment between the words that can just take someone's breath away. And you don't have to say another word after it. If you do it correctly, you'll have them immediately. And they'll do whatever they can for you because they know how important it is.
Oh, very, very well said. And you know what, John?
What's that?
I see that we are actually almost at a half an hour, and I told you 15 minutes, so...
That's okay.
I really appreciate you sitting down with me today.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me, Pam.
How can our listeners find you?
Well, they can find me on the Twitter, if they wish, at John Lepp, L-E, two P's as in Peter, or at agentsofgood.org, where we blog quite a bit about this sort of thing and show some of the work that some of our clients are doing for their donors. And I'm everywhere in some cases. So, but that should be a good start.
Well, very cool. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Pamela.